Because I feel like the lasting impression that people have of manufacturing is the really old I Love Lucy episode where they're making chocolate. You know, like, that's what people think of manufacturing. It's really not like that at all.
Laverne and Charlie putting the tops on the beer bottles, right?
Exactly. Hello and welcome to Make It, Move It, Sell It. On this podcast, I talk with company leaders about how they're modernizing the business of making, moving, and selling products, and having fun along the way. I'm your host, Adam Honig, the CEO of Spiro.ai. We make amazing software for companies in the supply chain, but we're not talking about that today. Instead, today, we're talking to Mike Nagger, the manager of solutions at Festo Didactic. But, you know, probably more interesting to people here on the podcast, a published author and an expert on Industry 4.0. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Thank you, Adam. I appreciate the invitation and very happy to be here.
Oh, awesome. Maybe, Mike, before we kind of get into Industry 4.0 and some of the new and interesting things that you're seeing, maybe just tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to be such a, you know, knowledgeable person about these topics.
Yeah, so you went to school for an engineering degree, so I'm an electrical engineer by degree. And my first job right out of college was working for a manufacturer of a bunch of components we call industrial controls. So industrial controls are used by every other manufacturer, machine builder, to actually control the movement of their apparatus or their machines. And I kind of stayed in that field ever since I graduated from college. I typically was in a customer-facing position, so applications engineering or sales or product marketing. And as such, I got the opportunity to visit hundreds and hundreds of manufacturing locations throughout my career. And, you know, when you do it, you don't think it's that special until you start thinking about it and reflecting upon it and talk to people, you know, at cocktail parties that are in accounting or in different fields. And you're like, oh, yeah, you know, I was in a tire factory or an automotive factory or a pharmaceutical factory. And you start to realize, ah, this is not something that everyone has done in their career. And I started thinking, well, how can I take this knowledge that I have, or at least this experience, and share it with more people other than people that I can just talk to at a small gathering? So that's how I kind of started out. Yeah.
It's super interesting because I'm in a lot of factories as well, just a habit of my work. And I was talking with the manufacturing executive at Hershey's, and he was saying how excited he was that he got to go visit somebody else's factory. And I was like, wait, you don't get to go see other people's factories, but I do? That doesn't make any sense. But yeah, it's sort of a common thing, right?
Yeah, especially for the suppliers. I've worked for companies that have made connectors and cables and things of that nature. In sales, you're visiting all these customers every day, and you think that there's a community of, you know, people at Hershey and Nestle and all the other food manufacturers, but they can't go out as much. So it's kind of an interesting situation, you know, when you've seen 7 different plants of how potato chips are made.
Yeah. Potato chips is a good one. I haven't seen one of those, but I did see some other very interesting things. But tell me, so, you know, when you got to work with all these different types of companies, what, you know, was there any sort of interesting or unusual type of project that you got to see?
Yeah. So, you know, throughout my career, you know, I've been pretty fortunate to work on a lot of really cool projects. So I've worked on several USPS projects, are the Postal Service, with high speed sortation and delivering of packages and mail and letters and things of all that nature, and learning how that structure is set up between the post office and all the subcontractors that supply that, and all the machine builders that supply the subcontractors. So it's a very sophisticated system. And what you find is every industry has a very sophisticated system of supply chain and of how things are made. It's not a simple process. It's not just a single plant that's making. It's all these interconnected pieces that have to come together. So that was pretty cool. I worked on a New York subway project, you know, where they were trying to place some more instrumentation inside the subway tunnels, and got to go down behind the tunnels where you normally would stand and see the control rooms and how they
But no radioactive spiders while you were down there.
Yeah, we were fortunate in that case that we avoided all that. So wind turbine companies at their production facilities, you know, so it's really amazing stuff when you see it. Or even a battery factory, you know, I was at a double A battery factory in a very nondescript windowless building in South Carolina 20 years ago. And then you go in there and you find they are making 250 million double A batteries a year. You know, they're the production line so fast, you can't even see the individual batteries whizzing down it. And that was 20 years ago. So I can't even imagine even today what they're pumping out of that one facility. And all over the country, we have these nondescript windowless buildings producing things at this scale that the general public has no idea that's what's going on behind those corrugated steel walls. Part of what I'm trying to do, and part of why I think you invited me on, is trying to place a window into those walls so that people can see inside, be amazed by it, and maybe even encourage a young person to consider it for a career.
Yeah. Let's actually jump into that, because I've been speaking with a lot of people on the podcast who are trying to hire. And it's challenging for people to hire, and that there's sort of this sentiment that younger people are not really that interested in manufacturing. It doesn't sound, you know, sexy like, you know, being a baseball player or even working in high tech or something like that. Are you seeing that same sort of challenge?
Yeah, very much so. So, and not without some good cause. You know, we have to rewind the clock to 1990. You know, that's where I kind of think of the modern era starting and what happened then. Well, you know, in the general public, what they see is they see declining manufacturing employment. And typically when you have declining employment in a sector, that's not something that you would encourage someone that you care about to go into, right? It seems counterproductive. But yeah, manufacturing still has the reputation of being dull, dangerous, and dirty, and not something that a lot of people, unless they have someone that's close to them that knows differently, is going to consider out of the blue. So the manufacturing community, especially now that as a country, we're rethinking this idea of offshoring to faraway places in the world and have come up with the concept of reshoring and bringing things closer to home or nearshoring, bringing things to Mexico or to Canada instead of Taiwan or China. Now it's like, well, how are we going to supply all these workers, right?
Yeah.
And it's a huge issue for manufacturers. It's a huge issue for the education system. Some of your previous guests have mentioned it, and I agree 100%. There's a big job ahead of us.
Yeah. I mean, I've been kind of nurturing this idea that I think that we need a good movie about manufacturing. You know, something like The Social Network, but for manufacturing, or maybe in a Marvel movie or something like that. Because I feel like the lasting impression that people have of manufacturing is the really old I Love Lucy episode where they're making chocolate. You know, like that's what people think of manufacturing. It's really not like that at all.
Laverne and Shirley putting the tops on the beer bottles, right?
Exactly.
That's a wonderful idea. We should pitch it to someone in Hollywood. I could see a Jack Bauer 24 episode, you know, got to save the world with the manufacturing of some things. And actually, during COVID, we came pretty close to a real-life example of that. A lot of companies, including the one I work for, jumped into the fray and said, how can we do things very, very quickly to try to alleviate the worst of what we feared might come with the COVID crisis?
So. Yeah, so in that movie, would it be, you know, Pfizer manufacturing or the suppliers, or how do you envision that going forward?
Yeah, there could be a whole different bunch of angles, and like what we said before, there's so many players that have to come together to make the whole thing work, including the supply chain folks. There could be a lot of heroes to that story for sure.
Yeah, interesting. Now, I know part of your work is also focused on, you know, not just awareness, but training and education of younger people to get them into manufacturing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so my work with Festo Didactic. Festo Didactic is a branch of the Festo Corporation, which is a privately held German company that produces, for the most part, industrial controls. So we manufacture pneumatic and electronic controls that go into machines and utilities and all sorts of apparatus. The division that I work for is a relatively small division of that company, and we are focused on the education and training system. As many of your listeners probably know, Germany has a very envied apprentice and training program in their country, where very highly skilled workers are produced in scale. And part of that, a big part of that, is hands-on experience. So the concept of being an engineer and being theoretical engineer is kind of like an oxymoron to them, right? So if you're going to be an electrical engineer, a mechanical engineer, a manufacturing engineer, the idea is you need hands-on experience with the equipment that you're going to be working with in the factory. So what Festo Didactic does is we work with universities, technical schools, community colleges that have some interest in industrial maintenance, industrial engineering, manufacturing engineering, and say, we can help you build that laboratory so that the students actually get hands-on experience with the exact equipment or very similar equipment to what they will see in these factories when they graduate. And we work with the school or the professor or the program. Like, okay, do you need some robots? Yes, of course, everybody needs some robots. Do you need a conveyor? Yep, we need a conveyor. Do you need an automated storage and retrieval system? Yep, we need that. And we put together what we call a learning factory. And the learning factory starts with a customer placing an order for some sort of widget into their system. And at the output, if they do everything correctly, the widget comes out. And students learn about programming, cybersecurity, maintenance, mechanics, more and more information, so all of the products are coded with RFID and updated continuously in the manufacturing process, so there's no black hole of manufacturing, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I do, and it's pretty cool because I get to go out to campuses and talk to people that are very leading-edge folks in the field and publishing papers all the time and have their own ideas, and a lot of their ideas get incorporated back into what we offer to the rest of the world. So
gotcha.
Very fulfilling.
And this type of program, so this is offered to engineering schools? Is that the primary?
Yeah, typically engineering schools, technical schools that have an industrial maintenance or an industrial mechanics or a mechatronics. That's kind of a new word for us in the U.S. as well, a mechatronics degree. And, truthfully, a lot of these graduates coming out of the two-year schools will get job offers just as lucrative as or as good as those coming out of the four-year programs. There's been a real shift in the last 10 years for a very fast, hands-on, practically oriented training or education that gets people out there and working very, very quickly. So part of what we try to do is, you know, whenever you hire a new employee, there's a period of time of on-the-job training.
Yep.
We try to shorten that on-the-job training a little bit for the future employer. Because
that's great.
You know, maybe the person coming out of the program is like, oh, there's a robot. I know how to download a program into that robot, or I know how to pull that program off of the robot. You don't have to show me. I did that in my school project, right? So just make it a little bit easier for everybody involved.
Definitely. But it also seems like it really would reduce the risk. I mean, a big challenge for all employers is, okay, you're going to hire somebody. It's hard to find them. It's hard to evaluate them. You get them in. And then, you know, how many work out?
Yeah.
And I would imagine that if they go through that kind of program, that they could really, the success rate would be a lot higher too.
The success rate is a lot higher. And, I think there's probably some evidence that people are more likely to stay with a company longer when they do have that training, because they're more quickly integrated into the whole system. They're placed on tracks for promotion faster and things of that nature. So,
gotcha. And so are you seeing sort of a trend, you know, a lot of people have been talking about this, about, you know, bringing a lot more manufacturing capability back to the U.S. You must be seeing that happening all the time then.
Yeah, we're seeing it happen, and the tricky part about it is there's a lag time. So, you know, for your folks in industrial controls, you know that lag time is something that's very hard to deal with, and that's the period of when you say, okay, we're going to do something, and when you start to see results, because we're talking about training programs that are at least typically 18 months long at a very minimum, right? or 2 years. But it even goes further back from that. You have to establish the program. You have to get the space. You have to get the professors or the instructors, you know, so that keeps on coming back. But
well, that's okay, because we have to build the factories, you know, get the materials, you know, find the customers. There's all this other stuff that can go on while you're taking care of all of that, I imagine.
Yeah. There's a lot of things that kind of have to work in parallel to make it work. But yeah, definitely, I think the writing's on the wall. Reshoring is a real thing now. It's become a national defense issue, not an economic issue, which I feel is the shift. You know, in the 90s and the 2000s, everything was done on an economic basis.
Yep.
You know, what's the lowest price I can get for this widget? And, you know, it doesn't matter where it's produced. But when the Department of Defense says, well, we need that widget for our, you know, 114s or Abram tanks, and we should have a domestic supply, that's a whole different set of criteria, right? So,
yeah.
So, and that's what has kicked this off. The Department of Defense over 10 years ago looked at the supply chain and realized that we were in pretty bad shape, you know, should hostilities break out in different parts of the world and our supply chain was interrupted. And they actually started manufacturing institutes all around the country to try to jumpstart this process. So there's about 15 of them all around the country right now doing something in parallel.
So. Gotcha. So this was all kind of happening at the same time the Industry 4.0 kind of movement has been taking place. So it was kind of a parallel development, would you say, or
yeah.
Is it related?
Yeah, I would say parallel, because Industry 4.0 is the result of these technologies that have been developed outside of manufacturing. I mean, manufacturing in a lot of ways leads in some thought processes, but in other ways is a follower. And all these IIoT or IoT type concepts and devices are making their way into manufacturing today. So, you know, the Germans were able to come up with Industry 4.0 as a nice little way of encapsulating what was happening. I've seen it throughout my career working in industrial controls, you know, having more sensors, pick up more pieces of information, have more controllers analyze that and do some action on it without human interaction. So it was all kind of morphing this way. But until Industry 4.0 came out, we didn't have a nice little term to encapsulate it with. It's kind of a marketing term.
Well, I understand. But like, I think you're right when you say that, you know, it encapsulates it. It gives people a banner to rally behind, you know, gives people a sense that things are changing, which is important.
Yeah, because before that, you know, everyone was referring it to as a different thing. So, you know, I think GE got out there with smart factory. So that was probably the most popular alternative. But other people said smart manufacturing, and some other folks called it advanced manufacturing. And they all meant something a little bit different. So it was a little bit confusing. So Industry 4.0 was nice because it kind of wrapped everything up nicely.
Gotcha. So I'm super curious. So I know you've published a number of books, you know, focused really back on this, you know, training and awareness sector. What, you know, tell me a little bit about the thought process, you know, going from being sort of in industry to an author.
Yeah. So, you know, I described a little bit what I did about Festo Didactic, going into the schools and making sure that their learning factories were up to date and looked fantastic. So prospective students coming by would be like, oh, I'm going to get to work on that in this program, you know, I want to come here. So the aesthetics of what we provide are outstanding. So that's what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis. But as I visit these schools, I started to notice something, and this alludes a little bit to your earlier point, is that, you know, if that classroom could hold, let's just say, 20 students, when I went into them, for the most part, I'd see 6 students, 7 students, 8 students, 9 students. Barely half of the capacity was being fulfilled with actual students in seats. And I was like, there's something going on here, right? We can build the mousetrap, right? But if there's no mice coming by, we're not going to get them, right?
You needed some cheese, it turns out.
We need some cheese, because I think one of your previous guests, Chad Moutre from the Manufacturing Institute, he says something like there's like 600,000 1,000 job openings right now. Well, the truth of the matter is if every technical school and every technical university was at 100% capacity, and we made three shifts of them, so we had, you know, an eight-hour shift, an eight-hour shift, and an eight-hour shift, we would be hard-pressed to come up with that 600,000 workers being produced. And to further that, I'm going into a lot of classrooms, and I'm seeing they're at 50% capacity, 40%, 60% capacity. If it drops below 40, then usually the program's canceled. So I was like, there's something going on here. I think what is needed is someone in the industry has to reach out to students, to parents, to guidance counselors in high schools, to maybe even elected officials that control the school board budgets and direction, and tell them that manufacturing is coming back. Manufacturing is not dirty, dull, and dangerous. Manufacturing can offer very good benefits and very good salaries and very good job opportunities. Someone should do that. It took me a little while, and I was like, well, maybe I'm the somebody, and what could I do? And that's where I came up with the idea of publishing books written for lay people, people not in the manufacturing or engineering industry, but someone that has an interest or a potential interest in it, that could open it up and read without needless complication or jargon or acronyms what's going on in manufacturing.
So you don't have to know about MRP or bill of materials, in other words, to really get into
this. Yeah, no three-letter acronyms, TLAs. No TLAs are allowed. So that's what I kind of envisioned my purpose to be in the secondary endeavor. How can we encourage people to even consider manufacturing a career? Because for a lot of young folks, it's not even a consideration. If they get into it later, they kind of fell into it. It was not something that was planned for a very long time. And for 600,000 job openings, we can't just be waiting for people to fall into it by accident. It has to be a very proactive and engineered way of getting people into it. So
yeah, well, I completely agree with you. I mean, obviously, spreading awareness and getting people to understand that these are well-paying, you know, lucrative positions in good industries, but actually that require a lot of technical, you know, insight. There's real challenges here to be solved, which are quite interesting for people.
Yeah, and definitely. And the skill sets that you learn in these types of programs, I always like to say, are not limited to a very narrow manufacturing field as well. I mean, we're talking about the service industry. A lot of people left manufacturing and got into service, you know, for one reason or another, for their choice or not even their choice. But even the service industry is changing. So there is now robots being utilized in fast food and restaurants, and automation is hitting that as well. So there's going to be a need for people with these types of skill sets and this type of mindset, even outside of manufacturing. So you're in no way limiting yourself to a certain field. It's coming everywhere. People with these skill sets are going to be very well served going into the future for sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, for our listeners, Mike has agreed to give a free copy of his book, The Smart Student's Guide to Smart Manufacturing in Industry 4.0, to anybody who reaches out on LinkedIn. Mike, maybe you can just tell folks how they can get a hold of you on LinkedIn.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from anyone that's interested in manufacturing or technical education, or just interested in the subject in general. So on LinkedIn, my username is Mike Negger, no spaces or underscores or anything, just Mike Negger, and you'll find me pretty quick. There's not too many of us out there. So
cool. Well, it's been great having you on the podcast, Mike. I think this is extremely important work that you're doing, you know, getting, you know, building the awareness, giving people a set of the skills that they need to be productive. I can't imagine, I would love for people to be doing that for me, to be training employees before they came to Spiro. If anybody out there is doing that, just let me know. I definitely want to hear about it. But it's been really great to have you on the podcast and learn all about that.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, and thanks for championing the cause. I've listened to several of the other episodes. I was very impressed by the content. And I agree with all your other guests as well about this. So Thank you.
Well, thank you. And as a reminder to our listeners, you can find every episode of the Make It, Move It, Sell It podcast at spiro.ai/podcast. And I don't know, Mike, you think we should have people, you know, give us a good rating or something like that if they like the episode?
Yeah, I definitely think you should get a 5-star rating.
I think a five-star rating for this episode for sure. And don't forget to subscribe. If you got value out of the podcast, feel free to tell a friend, too. Maybe they would like it. Thanks to everybody for tuning in, and we look forward to speaking to you on the next episode.